held the high pass. Even Bethod had thought that there was no way round, but Logan had found a way up the frozen cliff and settled that score. He could see no way up here, though, not without an hour or two to spare. Cliffs of leaning blocks heavy with dead creeper, crags of tottering stonework slick with moss, seeming to lean and tip as the clouds moved fast above. "How the hell you planning to get up?" She was already halfway up one of the pillars. She didn't so much climb as swarm like an insect, hand over hand. She paused at the top for a moment, found a footing she liked, then sprang through the air, right over Logan's head, landed on the wall behind, and scrambled up onto it, sending a shower of broken mortar down into his face. She squatted on the top and frowned down at him.
"Just try not to make too much noise," she hissed,
then was gone. "Did you see?" muttered Logan, but the others had already moved further into the damp shadows, and he hurried after them, not wanting to be left alone in this overgrown graveyard. Quai had pulled his cart up further on, and was leaning against it beside the restless horses. The first of the Magi was kneeling near him in the weeds, rubbing at the lichen-crusted wall with his palms.
"Look at this," snapped Baez as Logan tried to edge past. "These carvings here, masterpieces of the ancient world, stories and lessons and warnings from history."
His thick fingers brushed gently at the scarred stone.
"We might be the first men to look upon these in centuries."
"Hmm," muttered Logan, puffing out his cheeks.
"Look here."
Baez gestured at the wall.
"Eowyn gives his gifts to his three oldest sons, while Glustrod looks on from the shadows. The birth of the three pure disciplines of magic. Some craftsmanship, eh?"
"Right."
"And here," grunted Baez, knocking some weeds away and shuffling along to the next mossy panel, "Glustrod plans to destroy his brother's work."
He had to tear at a tangle of dead ivy to get at the one beyond.
"He breaks the first law. He hears voices from the world below, you see? He summons devils and sends them against his enemies. And in this one," he muttered, tugging at the weight of brown creeper, "let me see now. Glustrod digs," muttered Quai. "Who knows? In the next one, he might even have found what he's looking for."
"Hmm," grumbled the first of the Magi, letting the ivy fall back across the wall. He glowered at his apprentice as he stood up, frowning.
"Perhaps sometimes the past is better left covered."
Logan cleared his throat and edged away, ducked quickly under a leaning archway. The wide space beyond was filled with small, knotty trees planted in rows but long overgrown. Great weeds and nettles, brown and sagging rotten from the rain, stood almost waist-high around the mossy walls.
"Perhaps I should not say it myself," came Longfoot's cheerful voice, "but it must be said. My talent for navigation stands alone. It rises above the skills of every other navigator as the mountain rises over the deep valley."
Logan winced. But it was Baez's anger or Longfoot's bragging, and that was no choice at all.
"I have led us across the great plain to the river Eos without a deviation of even a mile."
The navigator beamed at Logan and Luther as though expecting an avalanche of praise.
"And without a single dangerous encounter in a land reckoned among the most dangerous under the sun."
He frowned.
"Perhaps a quarter of our epic journey is now safely behind us. I am not sure that you appreciate the difficulty involved. Across the featureless plain, as autumn turns to winter, and without even the stars to reckon by."
He shook his head.
"Truly, the pinnacle of achievement is a lonely place."
He turned away and wandered over to one of the trees.
"The lodgings are a little past their best, but at least the fruit trees are still in working order."
Longfoot plucked a green apple from a low-hanging branch and began to shine it on his sleeve.
"Nothing like a fine apple, and from the Emperor's orchard, no less."
He grinned to himself.
"Strange, eh? how the plants outlast the greatest works of men?
Luther sat down on a fallen statue nearby, slid the longer of his two swords from its sheath, and laid it across his knees. Steel glinted mirror-bright as he turned it over in his lap, frowned at it, licked a finger, and scrubbed at some invisible blemish. He pulled out his whetstone, spat on it, and carefully set to work on the long, thin blade. The metal rang gently as the stone moved back and forward. It was soothing, somehow, that sound, that ritual, familiar from a thousand campfires of Logan's past.
"Must you?" asked Brother Longfoot. "Sharpening, polishing, morning and night. It makes my head hurt. It's not as if you've even made any use of them yet. Probably find when you need them that you've sharpened them away to nothing, eh?"
He chuckled at his own joke.
"Where will you be then?"
Luther didn't even bother to look up.
"Why don't you keep your mind on getting us across this damn plain and leave the swords to those who know the difference?"
Logan grinned to himself. An argument between the two most arrogant men he had ever met was well worth watching, in his opinion.
"Huh," snorted Longfoot. "Show me someone who knows the difference, and I'll happily never mention blades again."
He lifted the apple to his mouth, but before he could bite into it, his hand was empty. Luther had moved almost too fast to follow and speared it on the glinting point of his sword.
"Give me that back!"
Luther stood up. "Of course." He tossed it off the end of the blade with a practiced flick of his wrist. Before Longfoot's reaching hands could close around it, Luther had snatched his short sword from its sheath and whipped it blurring through the air. The navigator was left juggling with the two even halves for a moment before dropping them both in the dirt.
"Damn your showing off!" he snapped.
"We can't all have your modesty," muttered Luther.
Logan chuckled to himself while Longfoot stomped back over to the tree, staring up into the branches for another apple.
"Nice trick," he grunted, strolling through the weeds to where Luther was sitting. "You're quick with those needles."
The young man gave a modest shrug.
"It has been remarked upon."
Stabbing an apple and stabbing a man were two different things, but quickness was some kind of start. Logan looked down at Pharaoh's sword, turned it over in his hands, then slid it out from its wooden sheath. It was a strange weapon, to his mind, grip and blade both gently curved, thicker at the end than at the hilt, sharpened only down one edge, with scarcely any point on it at all. He swung it in the air a couple of times. Strange weight, more like an axe than a sword.
"Odd-looking thing," muttered Luther.
Logan checked the edge with his thumb. Rough feeling, it dragged at the skin.
"Sharp, though."
"Don't you ever sharpen yours?" Logan frowned. He reckoned he must have spent weeks of his life, all told, sharpening the weapons he'd carried. Every night, out on the trail, after the meal, men would sit and work at their gear, steel scraping on metal and stone, flashing in the light of the campfires. Sharpening, cleaning, polishing, tightening. His hair might have been caked with mud, his skin stiff with old sweat, his clothes riddled with lice, but his weapons had always gleamed like the new moon. He took hold of the cold grip and pulled the sword that Baez had given him out of its stained scabbard. It looked a slow and ugly thing compared to Luther's swords, and to Pharaoh's, too, if it came to that. There was hardly any shine on the heavy grey blade at all. He turned it over in his hand. The single silver letter glinted near the hilt, the mark of Canadius.
"Don't know why, but it doesn't need sharpening. I tried it to begin with, but all it did was wear down the stone."
Longfoot had hauled himself up into one of the trees and was slithering along a thick branch towards an apple hanging out of reach near its end.
"If you ask me," grunted the navigator, "the weapons suit their owners to the ground. Captain Luther, flash and fine-looking, but never used in combat. The woman, Malgin, sharp and vicious and worrying to look upon. The Northman, Nine Fingers, heavy, solid, slow, and simple." "Ha!"
he chuckled, dragging himself slightly further down the limb.
A most fitting metaphor. Juggling with words has always been but one among my many remarkable...
Logan grunted as he swung the sword over his head. It bit through the branch where it met the trunk, clean through, almost to the other side. More than far enough that Longfoot's weight ripped through the rest and brought the whole limb, navigator and all, crashing down into the weeds below.
Slow and simple enough for you?
Luthar spluttered with laughter as he sharpened his short sword, and Logan laughed as well. Laughing with a man was a good step forward. First comes the laughter, then the respect, then the trust.
God's breath!
Shouted Longfoot, scrabbling his way out from under the branch.
Can a man not eat without disturbance?
Sharp enough, chuckled Luthar. No doubt. Logan hefted the sword in his hand. Yes, this Canadius knew how to make a weapon all right.
Making weapons is what Canadius did.
Baez had stepped through the crumbling archway and into the overgrown orchard.
He was the master maker, after all. The one that you hold is among the very least of what he made, forged to be used in a war against his brothers.
Brothers, snorted Luthar. I know exactly how he felt. There's always something, usually a woman in my experience. He gave his short sword one last stroke with the whetstone. And where women are concerned, I always come out on top.
Is that so? Baez snorted.
As it happens, a woman did enter the case, but not in the way you're thinking. Luthar gave a sickening grin.
What other way is there to think about women? If you ask me, gah!
A large clod of bird shit splattered against the shoulder of his coat, throwing specks of black and grey all over his hair, his face, his newly cleaned swords.
What the...
He scrambled from his seat and stared up at the wall above him. Pharaoh was squatting on top, wiping her hand on a spray of ivy. It was hard to tell with the bright sky behind, but Logan wondered if she might not have the trace of a smile on her face. Luthar certainly wasn't smiling.
You fucking mad bitch!
He screamed, scraping the white goo from his coat and flinging it at the wall.
Bunch of bloody savages!
And he shoved angrily past and through the fallen arch. Laughter was one thing, it seemed, but the respect might be a while coming.
In case any of you pinks are interested, called Pharaoh, the riders are gone.
Which way? Asked Baez.
Away east, the way we came, riding hard.
Looking for us?
Who knows? They didn't have signs. But if they are looking, more than likely they will find our trail.
The Magus frowned.
Then you'd best get down from there. We need to move.
He thought about it for a moment.
And try not to throw any more shit.
Chapter 13. And next, my gold.
To San Dan Glockta. Superior of Degoska, and for his eyes alone. I am most troubled to discover that you think yourself short of both men and money. As far as soldiers are concerned, you must make do with what you have or what you can procure. As you're already well aware, the great majority of our strength is committed in Angland. Unfortunately, a certain rebellious temper among the peasantry throughout Middleland is more than occupying what remains. As to the question of funds, I fear that nothing can be spared. You will not ask again. I advise you to squeeze what you can from the spices, from the natives, from anyone else who is to hand. Borrow and make do, Glockta. Demonstrate that resourcefulness that made you so famous in the Cantic War. I trust that you will not disappoint me. Salt, Archlector of His Majesty's Inquisition.
Matters proceed with the greatest speed, Superior, if I may say so. Since the gates to the upper city were opened, the work rate of the natives has tripled. The ditch is down below sea level across the entire peninsula and deepening every day. Only narrow dams hold back the brine at either end, and at your order, the entire business is ready to be flooded. Visbrook sat back with a happy smile on his plump face, quite as if the whole thing had been his idea. Below them in the upper city, the morning chanting was beginning, a strange wailing that drifted from the spires of the great temple out over Dagoska and into every building, even here, in the audience chamber of the citadel. Kadia calls his people to prayer. Verm's lip curled at the sound.
That time again already? Damn those natives and their bloody superstitions. We should never have let them back into their temple. Damn their bloody chanting, it gives me a headache.
And it's worth it for that alone. Glockta grinned. If it makes Kadia happy, your headache is something I can live with. Like it or not, we need the natives, and the natives like to chant. Get used to it is my advice. That, or wrap a blanket round your head. Visbrook sat back in his chair and listened while Verm sulked.
I have to admit that I find the sound rather soothing, and we cannot deny the effect the superior's concessions have had on the natives. With their help, the land walls are repaired, the gates are replaced, and the scaffolds are already being dismantled. Stone has been acquired for new parapets, but... Ah, and here is the problem. The masons refuse to work another day without money. My soldiers are on quarter pay, and morale is low. Debt is the problem, Superior.
I'll say it is, muttered Verms angrily. The granaries are close to capacity, and two new wells have been dug in the lower city at great expense, but my credit is utterly exhausted. The grain merchants are after my blood.
A damn sight less keenly than every merchant in the city is after mine, I dare say.
I can scarcely show my face any longer for their clamouring. My reputation is in jeopardy, Superior.
As if I had no larger concerns than the reputation of this dolt. How much do we owe?
Verms frowned. For food, water, and general equipment, no less than 100,000.
100,000? The Spicers love making money, but they hate spending it more. Ida will not come up with half so much if she even chooses to try. What about you, General?
The cost of hiring mercenaries, excavating the ditch, of the repairs to the walls, of extra weapons, armor, ammunition?
Visbrook puffed out his cheeks.
In all, it comes to nearly 400,000 marks.
It was the most Glockta could do to keep from choking on his own tongue. 500,000? A king's ransom and more besides. I doubt that Sulth could provide so much even if he had the mind, and he does not. Men die all the time over debts a fraction of the size.
Work however you can. Promise whatever you want. The money is on its way, I assure you.
The general was already collecting his notes.
I am doing all I can, but people are beginning to doubt that they will ever be paid.
Verms was more direct.
No one trusts us any longer. Without money, we can do nothing.
Nothing, growled Severard.
Frost slowly shook his head. Glockta rubbed at his sore eyes.
A superior of the Inquisition vanisheth without leaving so much as a smear behind. He retires to his chambers at night. The door is locked. In the morning, he does not answer. They break down the door and find nothing. The bed has been slept in, but there is no body, not the slightest sign of a struggle even.
Nothing, muttered Severard.
What do we know? De Voost suspected a conspiracy within the city, a traitor intending to deliver Dagoska to the Gurkish. He believed a member of the ruling council was involved. It would seem likely that he uncovered the identity of this person and was somehow silenced.
But who?
We must turn the question on its head. If we cannot find our traitor, we must make them come to us.
If they work to get the Gurkish in, we need only succeed in keeping them out. Sooner or later, they will show themselves.
Risky,
mumbled Frost. Risky indeed, especially for Dagoska's latest superior of the Inquisition, but we have no choices.
So, we wait? Asked Severard.
We wait, and we look to our defences. That, and we try to find some money. Do you have any cash, Severard?
I did have some. I gave it to a girl down in the slums.
Ah, shame.
Not really. She fucks like a madman. I'd thoroughly recommend her if you're interested.
Glockter winced as his knee clicked. What a thoroughly heartwarming tale, Severard. I never had you down for a romantic. I'd sing a ballad if I wasn't so short of funds.
I could ask around. How much are we talking about?
Oh, not much. Say, 500,000 marks.
One of the practical's eyebrows went up sharply. He reached into his pocket, dug around for a moment, pulled his hand out and opened it. A few copper coins shone in his palm.
12 bits, he said. 12 bits is all I can raise.
12,000 is all I can raise, said Magister Ida. Scarcely a drop in the bucket.
My guild are nervous. Business has not been good. The great majority of their assets are bound up in ventures of one kind or another. I have little cash to hand either.
I dare say you have a good deal more than 12,000, but what's the difference? I doubt even you have 500,000 tucked away. There probably isn't that amount in the whole city.
One would almost think they didn't like me. She snorted. Turning them out of the temple, arming the natives, then demanding money. It might be fair to say you're not their favorite person.
Might it be fair to say they're after my blood? And plenty of it, I shouldn't wonder.
It might, but for the time being at least, I think I've managed to convince them that you're a good thing for the city.
She looked levelly at him for a moment.
You are a good thing, aren't you?
If keeping the Gurkish out is your priority. That is our priority, isn't it?
More money wouldn't hurt, though.
More money never hurts, but that's the trouble with merchants. They much prefer making it to spending it, even when it's in their own best interests.
She gave a heavy sigh, wrapped her fingernails on the table, looked down at her hand. She seemed to consider a moment, then she began to pull the rings from her fingers. When she had finally got them all off, she tossed them into the box along with the coins. Glockter frowned.
A winning gesture, Magister, but I could not possibly.
I insist,
she said, unclasping her heavy necklace and dropping it into the box.
I can always get more once you've saved the city. In any case, they'll do me no good when the Gurkish rip them from my corpse, will they?
She slipped her heavy bracelets off her wrists, yellow gold studded with green gemstones. They rattled down amongst the rest.
Take the jewels before I change my mind. A man lost in the desert should take such water
as he is offered, regardless of the source. Cadia told me the very same thing.
Cadia is a clever man.
"He is. I thank you for your generosity, Magister."
Glockter snapped the lid of the box shut.
"The least I could do."
She got up from her chair and walked to the door, her sandals hissing across the carpet.
"I will speak with you soon." "He says he must speak with you now."
"What was his name, Shickle?"
"Malthus, a banker."
One more creditor come clamoring for his money. Sooner or later, I'll have to just arrest the pack of them. That will be the end of my little spending spree, but it will almost be worth it to see the looks on their faces.
Glockter gave a hopeless shrug. Send him in.
He was a tall man in his 50s, almost ill-looking in his gauntness, hollow-cheeked and sunken-eyed. There was a stern precision to his movements, a steady coldness to his gaze, as though he is weighing the value of all he looks at in silver marks, including me.
"My name is Malthus,"
I was informed, "but I'm afraid that there are no funds available at the present moment, unless you count Severard's 12 bits. Whatever debts the city has with your bank will have to wait. It will not be for much longer, I assure you. Just until the sea dries up, the sky falls in, and devils roam the earth." Malthus gave a smile, if you could call it that, a neat, precise, and utterly joyless curving of the mouth.
"You misunderstand me, Superior Glockter. I have not come to collect a debt. For 7 years I have had the privilege of acting as the chief representative in Degoska of the banking house of Valent and Bulk."
Glockter paused, then tried to sound offhand.
"Valent and Bulk, you say? Your bank financed the Guild of Mercers, I believe."
"We had some dealings with that guild before their unfortunate fall from grace."
"I'll say you did. You owned them from the ground up."
"But then we have dealings with many guilds and companies and other banks and individuals, great and small. Today, I have dealings with you."
"Dealings of what nature?"
Malthus turned to the door and snapped his fingers. 2 burly natives entered, grunting, sweating, struggling under the weight of a great casket, a box of polished black wood bound with bands of bright steel, sealed with a heavy lock. They set it down carefully on the fine carpet, wiped sweat from their foreheads, and tramped out the way they came, while Glockter frowned after them.
"What is this?"
Malthus pulled a key from his pocket and turned it in the lock. He reached forward and lifted the lid of the chest. He moved out of the way, carefully and precisely, so Glockter could see the contents. 150,000 marks in silver.
Glockter blinked. "And so it is."
The coins flashed and glittered in the evening light, flat, round, silver, 5-mark pieces. Not a jingling heap, not some barbarian's hoard. Neat, even stacks held in place by wooden dowels.
As neat and even as Malthus himself.
The 2 porters were gasping their way back into the room, carrying between them a 2nd box, slightly smaller than the 1st. They placed it on the floor and strode out, not so much as glancing at the fortune glittering in plain view beside them. Malthus unlocked the 2nd chest with the same key, raised the lid, and stood aside. 350,000 marks in gold. Glockter knew his mouth was open, but he could not close it. Bright, clean, gold, glowing yellow. All that wealth seemed almost to give off warmth, like a bonfire. It tugged at him, dragged at him, pulled him forward. He took a hesitant step, in fact, before he stopped himself. Great, big, golden 50-mark pieces. Neat, even stacks, just as before.
Most men would never in their lives see such coins. Few men, indeed, can ever have seen so many.
Malthus reached into his coat and pulled out a flat leather case. He placed it carefully on the table and unfolded it. Once, twice, 3 times. 1/2 of 1,000,000 marks in polished stones. There they lay on the soft black leather, on the hard brown tabletop, burning with all the colours under the sun. 2 large handfuls, perhaps, of multicoloured, glittering gravel. Glockter stared down at them, numb, and sucked at his gums.
Magister Ida's jewels seem suddenly rather quaint.
In total, I have been ordered by my superiors to advance to you, Sandan Glockter, Superior of Degoska, the sum of precisely 1,000,000 marks. He unrolled a heavy paper. You will sign here. Glockter stared from one chest to another and back. His left eye gave a flurry of twitches.
Why?
To certify that you received the money. Glockter almost laughed.
Not that. Why the money?
He flailed one hand at it all.
Why all this?
It would appear that my employers share your concern that Dagoska should not fall to the Gurkish. More than that, I cannot tell you.
Cannot or will not?
Cannot. Will not. Glockter frowned at the jewels, at the silver, at the gold. His leg was throbbing dully.
All that I wanted, and far more. But banks do not become banks by giving money away.
If this is a loan, what is the interest? Malthus flashed his icy smile again. My employers would prefer to call it a contribution to the defense of the city. There is one condition, however.
Which is?
It may be that in the future, a representative of the banking house of Valent and Bulk will come to you requesting favors. It is the most earnest hope of my employers that, if and when that time comes, you will not disappoint them.
1,000,000 marks worth of favors, and I place myself in the power of a most suspect organization, an organization whose motives I do not begin to understand, an organization that, until recently, I was on the point of investigating for high treason. But what are my options? Without money, the city is lost, and I am finished. I needed a miracle, and here it is, sparkling before me. A man lost in the desert must take such water as is offered.
Malthus slid the document across the table. Several blocks of neat writing and a space for a name.
For my name. Not at all unlike a paper of confession. And prisoners always sign their confessions. They are only offered when there is no choice.
Glockter reached for the pen, dipped it in the ink, wrote his name in the space provided. That concludes our business. Malthus rolled up the document smoothly and precisely. He slipped it carefully into his coat. My colleagues and I are leaving Dagoska this evening.
A great deal of money to contribute to the cause, but precious little confidence in it.
Valent and Bulk are closing their offices here, but perhaps we will meet in Adua once this unfortunate situation with the Gurkish is resolved. The man gave his mechanical smile one more time. Don't spend it all at once. And he turned on his heel and strode out, leaving Glockter alone with his monumental windfall. He shuffled over to it, breathing hard, and stared down. There was something obscene about all that money, something disgusting, something frightening almost. He snapped shut the lids of the two chests. He locked them with trembling hands. He shoved the key in his inside pocket. He stroked the metal bindings of the two boxes with his fingertips. His palms were greasy with sweat.
I am rich.
He picked up a clear, cut stone the size of an acorn and held it up to the window between finger and thumb. The dim light shone back at him through the many facets, 1,000 brilliant sparks of fire, blue, green, red, white. Glockter did not know much about gemstones, but he was reasonably sure that this one was a diamond.
I am very, very rich.
He looked back at the rest, sparkling on the flat piece of leather. Some of them were small, but many were not. Several were larger than the one he held in his hand.
I am immensely, fabulously wealthy. Imagine what one could do with so much money. Imagine what one could control. Perhaps with this much I can save the city. More walls, more supplies, more equipment, more mercenaries. The Gurkish thrown back from Dagoska in disarray. The Emperor of Gurkle humbled. Who would have thought it? Sandan Glockter, once more the hero.
He rolled the shining little pebbles around with a fingertip, lost in thought.
but so much spending in so little time could raise questions. My faithful servant, Practical Vitari, would be curious, and she would make my noble master, the Archlector, curious. One day I beg for money, the next I spend it as if it burns. I was forced to borrow, Your Eminence.
Indeed, how much?
No more than 1,000,000 marks.
Indeed, and who would lend such a sum?
Why, our old friends at the banking house of Valentin Bulk, Your Eminence, in return for unspecified favours which they might call in at any moment. Of course, my loyalty is still beyond question. You understand, don't you? I mean to say, it's only a fortune in jewels. Body found floating by the docks.
He pushed his hand absently through the cold, hard, glittering stones, and they tickled pleasantly at the skin between his fingers.
Pleasant, but perilous. We must still tread carefully, more carefully than ever.
Chapter 14. Fear. It was a long way to the edge of the world, of that there could be no doubt. A long and a lonely and a nervous way. The sight of the corpses on the plain had worried everyone. The passing riders had made matters worse. The discomforts of the journey had in no way diminished. Giselle was still constantly hungry, usually too cold, often wet through, and would probably be saddle-sore for the rest of his days. Every night he stretched out on the hard and lumpy ground, dozed and dreamed of home, only to wake to the pale morning more tired and aching than when he lay down. His skin crawled and chafed and stung with the unfamiliar feeling of dirt, and he was forced to admit that he had begun to smell almost as vile as the others. It was enough altogether to make a civilized man run mad. And now, to add to all of this, there was the constant nagging of danger. From that point of view, the terrain was not on Giselle's side. Hoping to shake off any pursuers, Baez had ordered them away from the river a few days earlier. The ancient road wound now through deep scars in the plain, through rocky gullies, through shadowy gorges, alongside chattering streams in deep valleys. Giselle began to think on the endless, grinding flatness, almost with nostalgia. At least out there, one did not look at every rock and shrub and fold in the ground and wonder whether there was a crowd of bloodthirsty enemies behind it. He had chewed his fingernails almost until the blood ran. Every sound made him bite his tongue and spin around in his saddle, clutching at his steels, staring for a murderer who turned out to be a bird in a bush. It was not fear, of course, for Giselle Dan Luthar, he told himself, would laugh in the face of danger. An ambush, or a battle, or a breathless pursuit across the plain, these things, he imagined, he could have taken in his stride. But this endless waiting, this mindless tension, this merciless rubbing by of slow minutes, was almost more than he could stand. It might have helped had there been someone with whom he could share his unease. But as far as companionship went, little had changed. The cart still rolled along the cracked old road, while Kwai sat grim and silent on top. Baez said nothing, but for the occasional lecture on the qualities of great leadership, qualities which seemed markedly absent in himself. Longfoot was off scouting out the route, only appearing every day or two to let them know how skillfully he was doing it. Pharaoh frowned at everything as though it were her personal enemy, and at Giselle most of all, it sometimes seemed, her hands never far from her weapons. She spoke rarely, and then only to Ninefingers, to snarl about ambushes, or covering their tracks better, or the possibilities of being followed. The Northman himself was something of a puzzle. When Giselle had first laid eyes on him, gawping at the gate of the Agriont, he had seemed less than an animal. Out here in the wild, though, the rules were different. One could not simply walk away from a man one disliked, then do one's best to avoid him, belittle him in company, and insult him behind his back. Out here, you were stuck with the companions you had, and being stuck with him Giselle had come slowly to realize that Nine Fingers was just a man, after all. A stupid and a thuggish and a hideously ugly one, no doubt. As far as wit and culture went, he was a cut below the lowliest peasant in the fields of the Union. But Giselle had to admit that out of all the group, the Northman was the one he had come to hate least. He had not the pomposity of Baez, the watchfulness of Quai, the boastfulness of Longfoot, or the simple viciousness of Ferro. Giselle would not have been ashamed to ask a farmer his opinion on the raising of crops, or a smith his opinion on the making of armour, however dirty, ugly, or low-born they might have been. Why not consult a hardened killer on the subject of violence? "I understand that you have led men in battle," Giselle tried as his opening. The Northman turned his dark, slow eyes on him. "More than once." "And fought in duels?" "Aye." He scratched at the ragged scars on his stubbly cheek. "I didn't come to look like this from a wobbly hand at shaving." "If your hand was that wobbly, you would choose perhaps to grow a beard." Nine Fingers chuckled. Giselle was almost used to the sight now. It was still hideous, of course, but smacked more of good-natured ape than crazed murderer. "I might at that," he said. Giselle thought about it a moment. He did not wish to make himself appear weak, but honesty might earn the trust of a simple man. If it worked with dogs, why not with Northmen? "I myself," he ventured, "have never fought in a full-blooded battle."
"You don't say."
"No, truly. My friends are in Angland now, fighting against Bethod and his savages." Nine Fingers' eyes swiveled sideways. "I mean, that is to say, fighting against Bethod. I would be with them myself, had not Baez asked me to come on this venture."
"Their loss is our gain."
Giselle looked sharply across. From a subtler source, that might almost have sounded like sarcasm. "Bethod started this war, of course. A most dishonourable act of unprovoked aggression on his part."
"You'll get no argument from me on that score. Bethod's got a gift when it comes to starting wars. The only thing he's better at is the finishing of them."
Giselle laughed.
"You can't mean that you think he'll beat the Union?" "He's beaten worse odds. But you know best. We don't all have your experience."
The laughter stuttered out in Giselle's throat. He was almost sure that had been irony, and it made him think for a moment. Was Nine Fingers looking at him now, and behind that scarred, that plodding, that battered mask, thinking, "What a fool?" Could it be that Baez had been right, that there was something to be learned from this Northman after all? There was only one way to find out. "What's a battle like?" he asked.
"Battles are like men. No two are ever quite the same."
"How do you mean?"
"Imagine waking up at night to hear a crashing and a shouting, scrambling out of your tent into the snow with your trousers falling down, to see men all around you killing one another. Nothing but moonlight to see by. No clue who are enemies and who are friends. No weapon to fight with."
"Confusing," said Giselle.
"No doubt. Or imagine crawling in the mud between the stomping boots, trying to get away but not knowing where to go, with an arrow in your back and a sword cut across your ass, squealing like a pig and waiting for a spear to stick you through. A spear you won't even see coming."
"Painful," agreed Giselle.
"Very. Or imagine standing in a circle of shields no more than 10 strides across, all held by men roaring their loudest. There's just you and one other man in there, and that man's won a reputation for being the hardest bastard in the North, and only one of you can leave alive."
"Hmm,"
murmured Giselle. "That's right.
You like the sound of any of those?"
Giselle did not, and Nine Fingers smiled. "I didn't think so. And honestly, nor do I. I've been in all kind of battles and skirmishes and fights. Most of them started in chaos, and all of them ended in it. And not once did I not come near to shitting myself at some point."
"You?" The Northman chuckled.
Fearlessness is a fool's boast, to my mind. The only men with no fear in them are the dead, or the soon-to-be dead, maybe. Fear teaches you caution and respect for your enemy, and to avoid sharp edges used in anger. All good things in their place, believe me. Fear can bring you out alive, and that's the very best anyone can hope for from any fight. Every man who's worth a damn feels fear. It's the use you make of it that counts.
Be scared? That's your advice?
My advice would be to find a good woman and steer well clear of the whole bloody business. And it's a shame no one told me the same 20 years ago. He looked sideways at Giselle. But if, say, you're stuck out on some great wide plain in the middle of nowhere and can't avoid it, there's 3 rules I'd take to a fight. First, always do your best to look the coward, the weakling, the fool. Silence is a warrior's best armor, the saying goes. Hard looks and hard words have never won a battle yet, but they've lost a few.
Look the fool, eh? I see.
Giselle had built his whole life around trying to appear the cleverest, the strongest, the most noble. It was an intriguing idea that a man might choose to look like less than he was. Second, never take an enemy lightly, however much the dullard he seems. Treat every man like he's twice as clever, twice as strong, twice as fast as you are, and you'll only be pleasantly surprised. Respect costs you nothing, and nothing gets a man killed quicker than confidence.
Never underestimate the foe, a wise precaution.
Giselle was beginning to realize that he had underestimated this Northman. He wasn't half the idiot he appeared to be. Third, watch your opponent as close as you can, and listen to opinions if you're given them. But once you've got your plan in mind, you fix on it and let nothing sway you. Time comes to act, you strike with no backward glances. Delay is the parent of disaster, my father used to tell me, and believe me, I've seen some disasters.
No backward glances, muttered Giselle, nodding slowly to himself. Of course.
Nine Fingers puffed out his pitted cheeks.
There's no replacement for seeing it and doing it, but master all that, and you're halfway to beating anyone, I reckon.
Halfway? What about the other half?
The Northman shrugged.
Luck.
I don't like this, growled Ferro, frowning up at the steep sides of the gorge.
Giselle wondered if there was anything in the world she did like.
You think we're followed? Asked Baez. You see anyone?
How could I see anyone from down here? That's the point.
Good ground for an ambush, muttered Nine Fingers. Giselle looked around him nervously. Broken rocks, bushes, scrubby trees. The ground was full of hiding places.
Well, this is the route that Longfoot picked for us, grumbled Baez, and there's no purpose in hiring a cleaner if you're going to swab the latrines yourself. Where the hell is that damn navigator anyway? Never around when you want him. Only turns up to eat and boast for hours on end. If you knew how much that bastard cost me... Damn it.
Nine Fingers pulled his horse up and clambered stiffly down from his saddle. A fallen tree trunk, wood cracked and grey, lay across the gorge, blocking the road.
I don't like this.
Ferro shrugged her bow from her shoulder.
Neither do I, grumbled Nine Fingers, taking a step towards the fallen tree. But you have to be real.
That's far enough! The voice echoed back and forth around the valley, brash and confident. Kwai hauled on the reins and brought the cart to a sudden halt. Giselle looked along the lip of the gorge, his heart thumping in his mouth. He saw the speaker now. A big man, dressed in antique leather armor, sitting carelessly on the edge of the drop with one leg dangling, his long hair flapping softly in the breeze. A pleasant and a friendly-looking man, as far as Giselle could tell at this distance, with a wide smile on his face.
"My name is Phineas, a humble servant of the Emperor Cabrian."
"Cabrian!" shouted Baez. "I heard he'd lost his reason."
"He's got some interesting ideas," Phineas shrugged, "but he's always seen us right. Let me explain matters. We're all around you."
A serious-seeming man with a short sword and shield stepped out from behind the dead tree trunk. Two more appeared, and then three more, creeping out from behind the rocks, behind the bushes, all with serious faces and serious weapons. Giselle licked his lips. He would laugh in the face of danger, of course, but now it came to it, nothing seemed at all amusing. He looked over his shoulder. More men had come from behind the rocks they had passed a few moments before, blocking the valley in the other direction. Nine Fingers folded his arms. "Just once," he murmured, "I'd like to take someone else by surprise."
"There's a couple more of us," shouted Phineas. "Up here with me, good hands with bows and ready with arrows."
Giselle saw their outlines now against the white sky, the curved shapes of their weapons.
"So you see that you'll be going no further down this road."
Baez spread his palms.
"Perhaps we can come to some arrangement that suits us both. You need only name your price and—"
"Your money's no good to us, old man, and I'm deeply wounded by the assumption. We're soldiers, not thieves. We have orders to find a certain group of people. A group of people wandering out in the middle of nowhere, far from the travelled roads. An old bald bastard with a sickly-looking boy, some stuck-up union fool, a scarred whore, and an ape of a northerner. You seen a crowd that might fit that description?"
"If I'm the whore," shouted Nine Fingers, "who's the northerner?"
Giselle winced. "No jokes, please, no jokes." But Phineas only chuckled.
"They didn't tell me you were funny. Reckon that's a bonus. At least until we kill you. Where's the other one, eh? The navigator?"
"No idea," growled Baez. "Unfortunately, if anyone dies, it should be him."
"Don't take it too hard. We'll catch up with him later."
And Phineas laughed an easy laugh, and the men around them grinned and fingered their weapons.
"So, if you'd be good enough to give your arms to those fellows ahead of you, we can get you trussed up and start back towards Darmium before nightfall."
"And when we get there?"
Phineas gave a happy shrug.
"Not my business. I don't ask questions of the Emperor, and you don't ask questions of me. That way, no one gets skinned alive. Do you take my meaning, old man?"
"Your meaning is hard to miss, but I am afraid that Darmium is quite out of our way."
"What are you?" called Phineas. "Soft in the head?"
The nearest man stepped forward and grabbed hold of Baez's bridle.
"That's enough of that," he growled.
Giselle felt that horrible sucking in his guts. The air around Baez's shoulders trembled, like the hot air above a forge. The foremost of the men frowned, opened his mouth to speak. His face seemed to flatten, then his head broke open, and he was suddenly snatched away, as though flicked by a giant unseen finger. He had not even time to scream. Nor had the four men who stood behind him. Their ruined bodies, the broken remnants of the grey tree trunk, and a great quantity of earth and rocks around them were ripped from the ground and flung through the air to shatter against the rocky wall of the gorge 100 strides distant, with a sound like a house collapsing. Giselle's mouth hung open. His body froze. It had taken only a terrifying instant. One moment, 5 men had been standing there, the next they were slaughtered meat among a heap of settling debris. Somewhere behind him he heard the hum of a bowstring. There was a cry, and a body dropped down into the valley, bounced from the sheer rocks, and flopped rag-like, face down in the stream.
"Ride, then!"
roared Baez, but Giselle could only sit in his saddle and gape. The air around the Magus was still moving, more than ever. The rocks behind him rippled and twisted like the stones on the bed of a stream. The old man frowned, stared down at his hands.
"No,"
he muttered, turning them over before him. The brown leaves on the ground were lifting up into air, fluttering as though on a gust of wind.
"No,"
said Baez, his eyes opening wide. His whole body had begun to shake. Giselle gawped as the loose stones around them rose from the ground, drifting impossibly upwards. Sticks began to snap from the bushes. Clods of grass began to tear themselves away from the rocks. His coat rustled and flapped, dragged upwards by some unseen force.
No!
Screamed Baez, then his shoulders hunched in a sudden spasm. A tree beside them split apart with a deafening crack, and splinters of wood showered out into the whipping air. Someone was shouting, but Giselle could scarcely hear them. His horse reared, and he had not the wit to hold on. He crashed onto his back on the earth, while the whole valley shimmered, trembled, vibrated around him. Baez's head snapped back, rigid, one hand up and clawing at the air. A rock the size of a man's head flew past Giselle's face and burst apart against a boulder. The air was filled with a storm of whipping rubbish, of fragments of wood and stone and soil and broken gear. Giselle's ears were ringing with a terrifying clattering, rattling, howling. He flung himself down on his face, crossed his arms over his head, and squeezed his eyes shut. He thought of his friends, of West and Jallanhorm and Casper, of Lieutenant Brint even. He thought of his family and his home, of his father and his brothers. He thought of Ardy. If he lived to see them again, he would be a better man. He swore it to himself with silent, trembling lips as the unnatural wind ripped the valley apart around him. He would no longer be selfish, no longer be vain, no longer be lazy. He would be a better friend, a better son, a better lover. If only he lived through this. If only he lived through this. If only... He could hear his own terrified breath coming in quick gasps, the blood surging in his head. The noise had stopped. Giselle opened his eyes. He lifted his hands from his head, and a shower of twigs and soil fell around him. The gorge was full of settling leaves, misty with choking dust. Nine Fingers was standing nearby, red blood running down his dirty face from a cut on his forehead. He was walking slowly sideways. He had his sword drawn, hanging down by his leg. Someone was facing him. One of the men that had blocked the way behind them, a tall man with a mop of red hair, circling each other. Giselle watched, kneeling, mouth wide open. He felt in some small way that he should intervene, but he had not the beginnings of an idea how to do so. The red-haired man moved suddenly, leaping forwards and swinging his sword over his head. He moved fast, but Nine Fingers was faster. He stepped sideways so that the whistling blade missed his face by inches, then he slashed his opponent across the belly as he passed. The man grunted, stumbled a step or two. Nine Fingers' heavy sword chopped into the back of his skull with a hollow clicking sound. He tripped over his own feet and pitched onto his face, blood bubbling from the gaping wound in his head. Giselle watched it spread slowly out through the dirt around the corpse. A wide, dark pool, slowly mingling with the dust and the loose soil on the valley floor. No second touch, no best of three. He became aware of a scuffling, grunting sound, and looked up to see Nine Fingers staggering around with another man, a great big man. The two of them were growling and clawing at each other, wrestling over a knife. Giselle gawped at them. When had that happened?
Stab him! Shouted Nine Fingers as the two of them grappled. Fucking stab him!
Giselle knelt there, staring up. One hand gripped the hilt of his long steel as though he were hanging off a cliff and this was the last handful of grass. The other hung limp. There was a gentle thud. The big man grunted. There was an arrow sticking out of his side. Another thud. Two arrows. A third appeared, tightly grouped. He slid slowly out of Nine Fingers' grip, onto his knees, coughing and moaning. He crawled towards Giselle, sat back slowly, grimacing and making a strange mewling sound. He lay back in the road, the arrows sticking up into the air like rushes in the shallows of a lake. He was still.
What about that Phineas bastard? He got away. He'll get others. It was deal with him or deal with that one there. I had that one. Course you did. If you could have held him another year, maybe Luther might have got round to drawing a blade, eh?
Strange voices. Nothing to do with him. Giselle wobbled slowly up to his feet. His mouth was dry, his knees were weak, his ears were ringing. Baez lay in the road on his back a few strides away, his apprentice kneeling beside him. One of the wizard's eyes was closed, the other slightly open, the lid twitching, a slit of white eyeball showing underneath. "You can let go."